Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting with Sherry is brought to you by Patreon listeners like you. If you would like to join their ranks, go to patreon.com/ReTheBard. That's patreon.com/RITHEBARD. And follow Sherry on all the various social networks at ReTheBard. That's RITHEBARD. And now, from the studios in San Diego, California, here's Sherry.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today, we're going to chat with Rob Roy McCandless about his books, Hell Becomes Her and Company of the Damned. I'd also like to thank the people who are following me on Patreon for your contribution and your support. Anybody who would like to join the ranks and follow me on Patreon, that would be wonderful. Also, I want everybody who is following me on iTunes to write a little review. Nice review, but a little review. Thank you. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sherry. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks.
Well, welcome back. I hear you've been having some adventures. Anything new that's popped up? Any conventions or book signings or anything that you would like to chat about?
Oh, nothing for me. I've been really focused on getting these latest two projects out, getting Hell Becomes Her out and the third and final book out. So I haven't done anything marketing related except for talk to you today.
Poor you. Well, I thought we would talk about something that every writer has difficulty with, including myself. It's easy to write a book, but it's not that easy to promote a book and to get it out there. Do you have a battle plan for getting the word out? Do you do online events? Do you do hangouts? What do you do to get the word out about your book, because you have new ones coming out?
Yeah, I do a little bit of everything that I have so far been introduced to. So I work in different groups on Facebook, and when it's permissible, I promote to them, and I do online promotions, and I work with a couple of different promotion companies and try to get the word out there. Of course, I have a base of followers that I will let them know the book is coming out so that they can have their money ready to pay for it the day that it's available and everything. So a little bit of everything. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so funny because when I was working customer service and I wrote my first book, they said, oh, well, you can quit now. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? You know how little a writer makes?
Yeah. It's like any other job. And, they don't just back up a dump truck of cash after you finish your first book. So,
well, even if you're a, world-famous author, I don't think that's an immediate thing. I mean, they all promote, even people who are known, they go to talk shows and radio shows and stuff like that, just like we do. It's not an immediate thing. I mean, even somebody like Dan Brown or Joe Rawlings, they still have to promote.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Patrick Rothfuss is everywhere. He's always doing interviews and he's doing pop-up chats with his fans, and he shows up at conventions, and, he's on Twitter telling you that he just signed books at an airport bookstore without anyone noticing. even those kinds of people who have essentially made it, they're still doing promotion work all the time.
You know, I'll never forget this. I was a kid, and my mom and dad loved talk shows, and one of the talk shows we watched was the Phil Donahue Show. And Phil Donahue wrote a book about, it was an autobiography, and he was at one of the local bookstores in front with his books, and there was no one there.
Oh, yeah?
I was, like, stunned.
Wow.
I walked over to him. And I got the book and I walked over to him to sign it and I said, "Where is everybody?" He goes, "That's my question too." He was really nice.
Wow. Yeah.
But isn't that crazy? I mean, he was one of the most famous people in America at that time. He interviewed presidents, you know.
Yeah.
Just nuts.
That's so funny. When I was living in Salt Lake City, right before I got married, I was supposed to go rock climbing with a friend. On the radio, it came on that Bruce Campbell was in town for his book, his first book, and he was going to be
at the
downtown bookstore. And I'm like, I called my friend. My phone was about to die. I called my friend, got her voicemail. I'm like, "Okay, I'm going to this thing. I'm canceling on you. I'm so sorry." And it was so packed. Like, you could not – it was standing room only, and I got there an hour ahead of time. It was crazy. So you even have to push your signing events. You can't expect people to not come.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just kind of crazy, and you never know because there are people who were really famous who went to places to teach. And one of the people that I saw was Ray Bradbury. He came to my college and to give a lecture, actually a couple times. He loved doing that. He loved talking to people that were young. That's who we related to. He was the nicest, friendliest, most affable, open person. I met him like three or four times, twice at college, once at a science fiction convention.
Mm-hmm.
He remembers you. He remembered. He's gone now. He remembered you. He was friendly. He was, I mean, the man didn't need to promote. He was the promotion.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But, it didn't stop him from doing stuff. He still went off and went to conventions and all kinds of stuff. But what was funny was he was there to promote one of his books, but all he wanted to talk about was dinosaurs at the convention.
At the convention. Yeah. When your book is done, in some ways you're kind of done with it. And even though the promotion has to go on, And it can take whatever, 6, 8, 12 months for a book to finally be published after you finished it. So you may have moved on to another project. He may have been doing something on dinosaurs.
Actually, I think he was doing a movie. I think that's why he was really into it. That he was, if I remember right, that's why he was one of the reasons. Well, he had a lifelong love of them. But I think he was there for... I forgot the name. Something Which Way Comes. I forgot the name. That's what he was there for. It was for a TV movie that he wrote.
Okay.
He wanted to talk about dinosaurs.
I think you let him talk about dinosaurs, right? He can talk about whatever he wants.
We all enjoyed it.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah.
He was one of those people you saw on stage and you didn't say a word, nope, except when it was time for question and answers. You just let them talk because they're just so entertaining and brilliant. It was one of those times you're at a convention that you could have dropped something and you could have heard it around the room because no one was talking. Everybody was listening to him.
Right. Yeah.
I only experienced that one other time, Gene Roddenberry. I only saw him once. I saw him at a big science fiction convention in downtown L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And, God, first of all, he was a brilliant, brilliant person speaking. I can't think of the word at the moment. Spokesman, talker.
Like an orator?
For real, what are you for? But also, because people had held him in such esteem that it was like, you know, he just came down from the heavens to speak upon us. But there was, again, not a peep in that audience. After the applause and standing ovation and everything,
mm-hmm.
nobody said a word. He just sat there and listened to him.
Right. He's such a big idea guy that you know, he just conveys that sense whenever he's up talking. So it's easy to get wrapped up in whatever he's talking about.
Yeah, he was talking about Star Trek Next Generation. That was his project that he was working on at that
mm-hmm.
time. It hadn't come out yet, and it was still in the baby stages, you know?
Uh-huh.
That's what he was
sure.
talking about. And of course,
was he still doing Phase 2 at that point, or was it actually Next Generation?
No, it was Next Generation. No,
okay.
He actually, because he was talking about the casting and stuff.
Ah, okay, yeah. I remember when they cast Patrick Stewart,
mm-hmm.
and he was like, okay, great, now I'm captain of the Enterprise, and somebody told him, you realize you are now an American icon, and it just kind
mm-hmm.
of floored him to have that realization that just being in that role, just being part of the show, made him instantly recognizable to so many people.
Yep. It's so funny because he went from Royal Shakespeare Company to Captain Picard, and it changed his life.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd been in Lynch's Dune, but mostly he'd done stage work. He was, just an amazing actor.
For Shakespeare.
But we were
he was
so
known
fortunate.
For Shakespeare.
Yeah. We were so fortunate to get him into sci-fi. It was just such a win. So, yeah.
Yeah, you can see it in Star Trek, but you can really see it in some of the
mm-hmm.
other parts. When he did Christmas Carol, his version.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, my God. You could really – I mean, it was like King Lear. I mean, you can see
right.
all the Shakespeare training just pouring out of him as he was playing that part.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's another thing about Gene Roddenberry. He cast stage actors, even though they had
mm-hmm.
experience in both TV and film. If you look at
right.
classics, Trek, Next Generation,
mm-hmm.
on all the other pilots and stuff that he did, that's who he went to. He went to Broadway. He went to people who had background.
Right, yeah. Well, and you can see that in some of those classic Trek cast,
mm-hmm.
like especially Nimoy was able to really springboard off of that and just had a whole career almost to the very end.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my mom and dad, when I was a kid, saw him in Fiddler on the Roof. And
uh-huh.
my dad goes, oh, I wonder what kind of padding, because he's so thin, what kind
yeah.
of padding he's going to play for half a Kevyet. But he didn't.
Yeah.
He's just
yeah.
he was just himself. But
his dad and
mom said he was the best Tevye.
Mm-hmm.
I said better than Topol, and he goes different, but amazing,
mm-hmm.
just amazing.
Right, it's worth
I
it to
never
see.
Saw Zero Mostel, so I couldn't compare that.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So all I know is Topol.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can definitely tell the difference.
Yeah. But I just thought that was interesting because everybody expected padding and the same
mm-hmm.
Zero Mostel and Topol did. Well, they were big guys anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he didn't do that. He did his own version, and I think that
right.
shows what a brilliant stage actor he was.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And he did a lot of stage. I think a lot of them did after,
mm-hmm.
but Nimoy especially. And he went on to do. You know, he just was able to do what he wanted after. After Trek gave him those springboards, he just could kind of do what he wanted, and he did.
Yep. Both Shatner and Nimoy were both Shakespearean trained, which I always find very
mm-hmm.
interesting if you watch their scenes together. because you can kind of see it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one, I was Conscience of the King, which was also a quote from Shakespeare. They're all Shakespeare's best in the classic track. Where the guy that played the old governor, who was the person who killed half the planet, I can't remember the name of the actor, but he was a really well-known Shakespearean actor. And they said, one of the critiques I read, and I was not around. I mean, I was around, but I was a baby, so I read this many years later. But one of the critiques I read about, Roddenberry was kind of worried about Shatner keeping up with him because he was such a Shakespearean actor, but all his training just went right in, and he did a magnificent job keeping up with him because actually being equal with him. Because some of those confrontation scenes that they would have would not have worked if he couldn't have kept up with him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's one of my favorite episodes.
And Shatner gets a bad rap, but he's done some very impressive work, and you have to look for some of it. But he was in a little black and white called The Stranger, and it's mesmerizing to watch him because he's not Captain Kirk at all in that. He's a totally different character, and he gets a bad rap for being like this one-note guy, but he really wasn't.
I can't remember the name of the movie he was in. It was the first time I ever saw him play a bad guy, and I was stunned because it was the first time I ever hated him as an actor. I loved him as Shatner, but the character, it was the first time I ever hated him. He played a Ku Klux Klan member, and it was just riveting. He was this beautiful, handsome man that you just hated. I mean, that takes talent.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
But, no, I mean, that's something I kind of miss, is that there's some people who do, and it's 50-50, but most people who go into acting think acting means TV and movies, and that they go into the television workshops and, classes like that, and theater isn't that important to them. And sadly, I think I see that. I think I see that TV is not important to them. I mean, TV. Theater is not important
to
them. And I think that's something we miss today, that foundation that they have in that.
Right.
That's how I feel.
It just opens your range, you know. You see an actor like Tatiana Maslany, and she definitely has a theater background. She's able to pull off what 7 different roles. Like some of them are a little blur the line a little between them, but for the most part, it's such great work. Obviously, it's award-winning work, and it's riveting at times just to realize that this is the same actress who was just there a minute ago as a totally different person.
Didn't she win a Tony?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Didn't she win a Tony Award?
Oh, I don't know if she won a Tony. I know she's won awards, and I'm pretty certain she got an Emmy for Orphan Black.
Yeah.
I remember the first year. Yeah.
I thought she got a Tony Award. I thought she got one for one of her Broadway shows.
That's possible. Yeah.
But I may be confused because you confused different award shows with different award shows.
Right, exactly. There's a lot, huh?
I know, they all mix up with each other. We're going to change tacks. I want to give you time to talk about your 2 books. Do you want to tell a little bit about what they're about and what you think would appeal to the audience the most?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Hell Becomes Her and forthcoming Company of the Damned, they're the continuation and the final chapter that started with my first book, Tears of Heaven. And they mostly focus on this character of Del, a half angel, half mortal, and she is essentially forced to work for the throne and banish demons to keep the world safe. And in the first book, it's kind of about how she lost and sort of starts to recover her own humanity. Being this semi-immortal, she loses people all the time, and that wouldn't be easy for anybody. And then she has to confront evil all the time, and that's even worse. So getting that back was kind of the theme of the first one. And then extending and growing into that is kind of the theme for Hell Becomes Her for the second book, where now she's learning to be a friend and she's learning to be part of a family and still have to do all this, you know, demon hunting and stuff. So it never stops, apparently. And then in the third one, she kind of has to grow into that position of not just being human and being concerned about other people, but really taking ownership and responsibility for a larger group of people that have put their trust in her. So the whole, you know, rolling theme for the three books and rounds out with Company of the Damned.
When you were creating your arc, what was did that come to you first, or did the storyline come to you for the first book first, or basically I'm asking how you structured it, because serials are something I'm working on. It's not a standalone book is not like a serial. A serial, you have to have an arc between all the books. How did you create your arc, and where did it come from?
Yeah, I remember the story didn't come to me first. It was the character. It was this, I was flipping through a publication requirements section of somebody, and they were talking about wanting darker fantasy, and I conceived of a character that was addicted to something. And so that's where I just started with the character. I could see her as this warrior, but the years had just worn on her so much that she had become an addict. And later I kind of rejected that wouldn't be something that would occur, but that's where the story started. And then what would she be, you know, what would she be aligned against, and how would all that work? And that's how the basic story functioned. And I always had this idea of the bigger picture of the twists and the final betrayal that would occur to her and how she would have to confront that. And so I always knew those, like that beginning point of who she was and the end point of where she would end up. And then it was just a matter of, you know, like I say this like it was easy. It only took 12 years, but filling in those blanks for those three books. So
it's not easy. It's not something that just pops into your head. A structure for a book, especially a series of books, it's sort of like a game where the sticks are, you have to pull out the stick without knocking everything down.
Mm-hmm.
you pull the wrong thread in something and everything comes falling down.
Yeah, and that's kind of the scary part about trying to do, you know, a really long arc, even just three books. You know, I can't imagine, like Robert Jordan has, he always knew how it was going to end, but that long arc across 15, 16 books, that's it almost becomes untenable because it's all in your head and you're bound to lose sight of something, or there's some logical framework that you've missed or something along those lines. So I always worried about that when I was working on it. And some things you just end up having to hand wave away anyhow. You're dealing with supernatural characters in a fictional setting and trying to make it realistic. It can become a little bit much, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. It's writing is not easy. It's not that everybody doesn't have the ability to do it. It's that not everybody has the concentration to do it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's not an elite set of people or anything like that. It's more like a determined set of people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like Louis L'Amour talked about how he, you know, had so many rejections in his desk, in his desk drawer. It was insane. And yet he just kicked out another story, sent it out to the publishers, see what they thought, kick out another story. And it's, you know, it's that dedication to the art and the ability to just suffer through it.
Yeah. I think that's really, really, it's hard. It's one of the hard parts of being a writer. Now that your books are done and gone off to the lovely publishing goddess, do you have another book planned, or do you have anything that you can tell us about?
Oh, yeah. So Del was such a dark character, and I'm not really a dark kind of guy. Like, I can get into some dark, but for the most part, I'm reasonably happy with my life. And so writing Del was sometimes kind of hard. And while I was working on the second book, a publisher approached me and wanted a short story for an anthology with Kevin Anderson. And I didn't have anything. I was like, oh, this sounds like a really great idea, but I don't have anything. And he's like, yeah, we just really want to get you in there. Okay. So I started spinning it around in my head on this character, and I wanted to do something steampunk. And I ended up writing a story about like a murder mystery story about this constable who has a clockwork leg because she lost it in the ongoing war, and she's been kind of pensioned off into this small backwater, but the backwater ends up being important and starts to grow, and so she ends up taking on more and more responsibility. So that story came out of that, and I loved the character so much because she was really kind of upbeat, even though she had all these problems going on, and she just seemed really fun, and so I started writing a whole story just for her, a whole book just for her, and so that's one that I'm working on right now.
Cool. That sounds really good.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Do we have a name yet for the series or the book?
I'm tentatively calling it The Constable Comes to Town, and the series will be, right? I know, that's like tentatively, here's what I'm thinking. Because I think that conveys some steampunk stuff, but also going back to some of that classic murder mystery stuff, you know, the postman rings twice and stuff like that. So
I'm sorry. The picture that comes to my head is not the right picture with that title. I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. Maybe I need to rethink it, but yeah, that's the working title. So yeah. Yeah, look for that.
I didn't mean to bust your bubble.
No, you're fine.
Sadly, we've come to the end of the interview. I just want to thank you for coming back, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sherry. It's always fun to talk to you.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Chatting with Sherry is brought to you by Patreon listeners like you. If you would like to join their ranks, go to patreon.com/rethebard. That's patreon.com/RIthebard. And follow Sherry on all the various social networks at rethebard. That's RIthebard. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.